Larry Jones came up to me after I'd put the mic on and said that because of the problems with the microphone, we were using about a battery per session, so he replaced the battery. And it occurred to me as he was doing so that a lot of us preachers are like that well-advertised battery. We keep going and going and going. But I'll try and avoid that tonight, even though the battery might have that capacity. As Cyril has announced, we're going to be thinking this evening about personal evangelism, and I want to be about as practical as I can be, because we're going to be talking about our upcoming gospel meeting. I suppose, in a sense, this is really just an extended announcement about that. But I think from time to time it does us good, whatever it might be about our service or about the way we do things, to just step back for a moment and think through why it is that we're doing that. I think that's sometimes true of the invitation, something that's so habitual, almost second nature to us, and yet we need to just think through what is it that we're trying to accomplish with that. And so in thinking about our gospel meeting, we have some 5 weeks before that meeting begins. And you might react to this by saying, well, you know, that's a lot of time in which to prepare for a meeting. And yet I would suggest to you that really the successfulness, to some degree, of the meeting will depend upon what we do in the next 5 weeks, as opposed to waiting till the point until that meeting begins on October the 1st. So let's just step back for a moment and ask the question, why have a gospel meeting? Have you ever considered that thought? Why should we even go to the effort of doing such a thing? Someone might immediately say, well, we do it every year. We do it twice a year, traditionally. And that may be a good reason, but it's not really the best reason to be having a gospel meeting. I suppose our concern, as always, is initially with, is it something that God has authorized us to do? Is this something that's acceptable in His will? And I would suggest that it is. Albeit we do not have an example of the early church, for instance, engaging in a gospel meeting such as we know it. And so we might ask the question, what is the precedent for having a gospel meeting? Well, even though the New Testament church, as far as I know, had no such effort where for a week they set aside a period of time as we do and maybe preach the gospel, although that may have occurred, I don't think of one offhand that was announced as such, where they met perhaps in the fashion that we do. I would suggest certainly by way of emphasis, there was an effort, an ongoing effort, among New Testament local churches to attempt to spread the gospel to others. It's almost too obvious to state it, but let's suggest that there are a number of passages that I think would demonstrate that. Acts 8 and verse 4 talks about the early church. It tells us that as that church had experienced such wonderful growth in its early stages, it met a point in time where persecution began to rise. In fact, that was really the case from the outset, but it arose to such an extent, if you can imagine it, that after the actual death of Stephen, saints had to flee from Jerusalem, except apparently for the apostles. Others sought to leave the area because of the persecution that they were facing. Now, under such duress, we might well imagine that maybe the authorities would be successful in stifling and stamping out the gospel. Just the opposite occurred. Because we're told in Acts 8 and verse 4 that when they went, they, as they were scattered abroad, went everywhere preaching the word. Now, that's just sort of an overall summary of what these people were doing. I don't know how they did that, how often they did that, but they did go to other places, and instead of quieting down, it seems like it just emboldened them to speak the gospel that much more. Another example is that in Acts chapter 13, where the church established up in Antioch of Syria had those among it called to go and preach elsewhere. And among those working with the church, Saul and Barnabas, in verse 2 it says, as they ministered and fasted, the Holy Spirit said, now separate to me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them. And this church was agreeable to that. instead of debating whether or not this would be a good idea or balking at the idea that these men, so successful among them, would now go out somewhere else, it says in verse 3 that they laid their hands upon them. They fasted and prayed, laid hands on them, which I understand to be a sign of their approval, and they sent them on their way. And much was accomplished by those efforts. Philippians chapter 4 is yet another example of a concern among New Testament Christians that the gospel be preached elsewhere. Verses 15 and 16, Paul says to the church at Philippi, "Now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. For even in Thessalonica, ye sent aid once and again for my necessity." We commonly think of our efforts, I think established in part on the basis of a passage like this, to give financial aid and assistance to those who are preaching the gospel as a means of spreading that word elsewhere. And we have often said that we support a number of men, which we do, many of whom have expressed publicly their gratitude for that help, so that they can go to places that we ourselves cannot go, but we can yet have a part in the gospel being preached in those places. Now, we could continue to enumerate other passages which demonstrate, I think, the same thing, all showing an emphasis on the spreading of the gospel elsewhere. That's one of the primary reasons why a local church exists. But all of that, I suppose, grows out of the emphasis that Jesus himself placed upon that responsibility. Jesus demonstrated, when he came to the earth, that concern for the lost. Jesus came to give himself as a sacrifice to others. In Luke 19 and verse 10, he said, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save the lost." And so there's certainly a sense in which Jesus came and gave himself as a sacrifice by which all men could be saved. But it's interesting to me that he didn't just spend his time, biding his time, until that point came where he would be offered as that sacrifice. Yes, there was a long period of preparation, apparently, but he spent some 3.5 years actually seeking out those who were lost. Why, one of the things we'll be undertaking in the next segment is a study of the life of Christ, and that's a study of Jesus going in his own community, to his own area, to other places where he was not readily accepted, and always making an attempt to seek out those who were lost, to try and prepare them for the coming kingdom. They needed to know that the kingdom was coming and that they needed to repent. And that was certainly his effort. And so much so that when he sends out his own apostles, he commissions them, as we know, the Great Commission. Matthew 28, 18 to 20, Mark 16, 15 and 16. Go and preach the gospel to the whole creation. That really summarizes what he was about. So it's really not too much of a stretch to understand that that's why we would make attempts, such as we do, to conduct a meeting in which we are preaching the gospel. Now let's think just for a moment about what that gospel is. Why is that message so important? The word literally has the idea of being good news. There was a time when a person might come back from a battle and announce the outcome of that battle. That messenger would bring news of what was taking place. There is a sense in which the gospel is a message to be announced. It's good news. But it is only good news understood in the context of what the bad news is. And that bad news is that people are in sin. Romans 3:23 is as basic as we can get. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And, of course, there are a lot of people who don't accept that premise. That's one of the reasons why it is hard to get people interested in the gospel, I'm convinced. They have never yet accepted the premise that they have done something that cuts themselves off with the very Creator who is the cause for their existence, and that they need fellowship with Him restored. I suppose it's a little bit like a situation we've experienced in the last couple of years. We've had a number of different anniversaries in reference to the Second World War. And it seemed like about every month there's some 50th anniversary of this event or that event, but I recall, I think it was last May, when there was a 50th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe. Now, I just have to say to you that that anniversary meant very little to me. And one of the reasons why that's the case is I was not around in 1945 when finally there was victory in Europe. But I can well imagine there are people in our audience here in whose minds that date is imprinted, because after 4 long years of struggle, finally victory came. Finally, the battle was over. Finally, there was not that same hardship that there had been. There was not that same concern for loved ones who might have been engaged. And so they understood the good news of victory, having understood the bad news of what the battle was about. And that's exactly the same with the gospel. The gospel really makes no sense to someone unless and until they fully understand what the bad news is. I was listening to a tape in a recent trip down to Florida. Floyd Chapelier, a gospel preacher, was talking about his efforts with other people. And he made an interesting observation as he was describing the method that he uses. He said, he talked about this idea of sin and confronting people with it and then trying to personalize it in the sense that he would talk to them about it and then have them actually admit to him or try and persuade them to admit that they were a sinner. And he said, if I can get them to admit that fact, I usually baptize them. And I didn't take that as a boast, but it was interesting to me that what he was saying is once they come face to face with that fact and that it applies to them, then it makes the gospel much more meaningful in their lives. Now, there may not be some simple way of doing that, but I would suggest, of course, that the first step in that process is allowing people an opportunity to hear the gospel. And that gospel becomes the good news of Jesus Christ. The gospel, Romans 1:16, that is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. It's the very way in which Paul lays out the epistle of Romans. He announces that the gospel is salvation, but he then undertakes to show that men are in need of salvation because they have sinned against God. But what needs to happen in order for that message to have an impact is that others must be exposed to the message. Now, just having someone hear that message does not guarantee its reception. Jesus demonstrates in the parable of the sower that it takes more than just a person hearing the word of the gospel and the gospel being preached in order for conversion to take place. Those are necessary elements. But it is also essential that a person's mind be open sufficiently to hear, to understand, to weigh in the balance what's being said, and then to apply it in order for that message to have an impact. And there may be people to whom we have spoken and we've tried to persuade them and that message has had little impact. And the fact is we can't really control what they're thinking or what they're going to do. But that doesn't lessen our obligation to try and have opportunity to teach them what the gospel is about. Paul says in Romans 10:17 that faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. That faith cannot result without first the word being heard, whether it's from reading it oneself or from hearing it preached. And that's where our responsibility comes in. We have to be those who, by way of example, who by way of encouragement, persuasion with others, make an attempt to offer the gospel to them. And we'll say a little bit about more about that in just a moment. You know, there are a lot of things that flow out of the good news of the gospel. There's a lot of teaching in the Bible that has to do with the nature of the church, the New Testament church, what it is, acceptable worship to God, what the work of the church is and what it is not. But really all those things flow out of this basic message that God wants to reconcile himself to mankind. And so I would suggest that just in essence, what we probably already know is that that's why we're having a gospel meeting. We want to try and encourage other people to come and hear this message. Regardless of what the outcome of that might be, it cannot be successful in terms of reaching others unless those things take place. I was listening to a respected, in my view, a gospel preacher saying recently that It used to be that when they held gospel meetings, they would go and set up a tent somewhere and they'd preach for 2 or 3 weeks until somebody started coming and listening. And he just made the observation and said, you know, I don't find too many congregations interested in doing that anymore. And maybe in some ways we've kind of lost sight of what we're trying to accomplish in that meeting. Certainly, good can be accomplished by us as members coming and listening to what's being preached. We are edified just by virtue of being here. But in addition to that, there must be that outreach in reference to those who need to hear the lesson of the gospel. And so it is that we need to give time and attention to that. Well, what does that mean then in terms of our responsibility? How do we get factored into this equation? I want to just raise some basic questions here and suggest some things that each of us might be able to do in way of considering and then really preparing ourselves for this upcoming effort. And I would certainly suggest that all these things are not related only to this particular effort. In reality, what we're talking about is something that ought to be an ongoing process. But surely with having a meeting like this that's approaching, having asked someone in whom we have sufficient confidence who can expound the scriptures in an understandable way, having made that, made those plans, and having asked him to come and having set aside the time, we want to make sure that in doing that, we can have a part in making this a successful effort. So what is it we can do? Well, the first thing in terms of our own responsibility that I would suggest is we need to think about who it is that we can invite. If we're going to have a part in this effort, and we're trying to think in terms of who might I invite to the meeting, it would do us well to just think through the possibilities that exist. As I suggested a moment ago, I think any group of God's people in a local church need to be constantly aware that we need to be looking outward and not just inward. Often, if we're looking inward, and that's where our attention is directed, we begin focusing on each other or on problems that might exist, and we really lose sight of what it is that we're about in terms of what we're trying to accomplish otherwise. Sometimes it can easily become, if we're not careful, a little bit like the Pharisees. The Pharisees, yes, were self-righteous, but they began to feel so smug and so insulated from the outside in their own environment that they began to just repudiate anybody who had anything to do with sin, and they would exclude themselves from that classification. And as a result, they really didn't want anything to do with the outside world. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're like that at all, but I would say that it can be very convenient and comfortable for us to begin to focus just upon the things that we do here. As important as they may be, it's equally important that we be making attempts to go out and reach others. Jesus, over in Luke 15, really confronts that problem among the Pharisees when he talks about the three different parables, about the lost sheep, the lost coin, and then the lost boys. Really, there were two of them. But in that parable, and we won't read through it, we'll just think about it for a moment. One of the things that comes through in that parable, Jesus is talking here to publicans and sinners. The Pharisees become aroused because he would even stoop to mingle with these people. And so Jesus tells these parables with the intention of impressing upon the Pharisees that God's desire, heaven's desire, is that these lost sinners be saved. And we need to keep that constantly before our own minds. We would repudiate the sin of those around us, the sinful society that seems to envelop us at times. We want nothing to do with that. But in our effort to be pure and holy, we cannot distance ourselves from other people who need the very gospel by which we've been saved. Someone has said it this way: it's like one beggar telling another beggar where the bread is. We're all in need of that. And we just need to think back to how we were before we had heard and received the gospel. And then in thinking about that, we need to reach out to those who are around us. Jesus says three different times, or at least a couple of times in the telling of this parables. Verse 7 and then verse 10, "Likewise I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. And that needs to be our attitude as we develop a concern for the lost. I would suggest that among those who are lost, there are both religious and unreligious. And both of those classifications can be those who are still lost. Sometimes it seems that most of our outreach is those who are already religious, and perhaps that's understandable. They already have an interest in the Bible. But even though they're religious, they still could be wrong. That doesn't mean that they're right. And our appeal to them is to look closely at what the Bible teaches, at what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, and try an interest in them in investigating that. But equally, we ought to be concerned with maybe someone who is not religious. Again, someone whose lifestyle seems so foreign to us, someone whose conversation, whose manner of speech is something we would distance ourselves from, and yet that person is one who is a prospect for the gospel. And so we need to be concerned with both of these in terms of trying to reach them. Well, in reference to that, let me mention one other passage. Mark chapter 6 and verse 34, I think, is a passage that's helpful along this line. You remember that after the second year of his ministry, Jesus hears the news that John the Baptist has been beheaded. And as a result of that, he wants to draw himself away from the crowd. But instead of being able to do that, just as soon as he goes somewhere else, why, they follow him. And he finds himself again surrounded by the crowd. Now, how do you suppose we would have reacted under those circumstances? We have lost a very good friend. We are sorrowing at his loss. We are constantly thronged by other people. We just want to be alone and by ourselves for a while. What did Jesus do on that occasion? Look at verse 34. It says, "And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them, because they were like sheep not having a shepherd." Now, Jesus could have reacted by saying, "Look, just send them away. I told you I want nothing to do with them. I need some time for myself. After all, I've got a busy schedule. I've got things to do." But Jesus had compassion on them. He recognized that these poor people were just like those sheep out there, scattered and wandering around. And so notice that in verse 34 it says, "He began to teach them many things." The best thing we can do for someone who needs our attention, our compassion, is to share the gospel with them. And anyone who fits that classification is a prospect for the gospel. How do we do that? Well, I think we have to forge some friendships sometimes. Maybe it's people at work, people at school, people who are our neighbors. We first have to maybe get to know them a little bit and then show an interest in them. But that does not suggest that if we don't have a friendship with them and haven't developed that to a certain level, that we can't share the gospel with them, that otherwise it's meaningless. There are countless examples in the book of Acts of conversions that take place spontaneously on the spur of the moment, simply because there was one who was ready and willing to listen to what the gospel had to say, and someone was there to share it with them. So whatever the situation be, whoever is listening and aware of what their need is a prospect with whom we can share the gospel. Well, that raises the question, how do we go about doing that? Suppose we focus in on someone and we decide that we're going to maybe just invite them to the meeting. How do we go about doing that? Now, as I've suggested, there are those who have great experience in doing that, and they would be maybe the first ones to whom we might go to either listen to their tapes or ask them, how do you go about doing this? What's the best way to approach someone? And I'm sure we would get marvelous insights into things that work in terms of talking with people about the Scriptures. I remember on one occasion I had another tape, and this one was of Harold Dowdy, another gospel preacher who I had always heard about in terms of his ability to do personal evangelism. And so I was excited to listen to it. I put it in, began listening to it. I was sitting with rapt attention as he began describing the efforts that he makes in the congregation where he was at the time to reach people with the gospel. And as I was listening, he began to describe those who might come and visit the service and how he would try and reach those people. And He stopped at one point and said, now, this is how I instruct people how to do that. And, of course, I couldn't see him. I could only visualize. He said, you take your hand and you wrap your fingers up into a ball and you go up to their door and you knock on the door. And when they come to the door, you speak to them about the gospel. Well, there wasn't anything mysterious or magical about it. He was just saying what you need to do is go and talk to them. No secret success method, just show an interest in talking to people. And maybe sometimes that's really what we need as much as anything, is just enough interest and compassion in others, enough appreciation of what it is that Jesus has done for us, to just open our mouths and begin talking with somebody else about the gospel. And to share that with them. Or to try and in some way work the discussion around to where we can share the gospel with them. And I would just suggest, in terms of the meeting that we have coming out, I don't usually like to do this, and this can be taken in other areas to some extreme that's not intended, but I like this in terms of the advertising message. I think it's Nike, isn't it? That says, just do it. That's what we need to do, is just do it. Talk to people. How do you react if you're in an elevator with someone and the elevator's going to the floor and you're sitting there and there's sort of a silence? Usually we'll mention the weather or something, try to get a conversation going. The point is, we'll talk to people if the circumstances is such that it's unnatural not to do otherwise. How natural it would be for us to share the gospel with them. And so it just takes the effort of doing that. Well, now, who would we do that with? I said a moment ago that anybody's a prospect. Who are our best prospects? And let me suggest here, in fact, I'll suggest in conjunction with the last point here, who is to be involved? I would suggest that all of us can to one extent or another. Who are our best prospects? If you want to go out tomorrow and focus on those best prospects, who would they be? Well, there's an easy way to find that. I would suggest, first of all, getting a piece of paper and writing down those people whom you know that are in the Atlanta area, obviously. Write those down, first of all. And then look at that list, and you've got a list of prospects, of people to whom you can speak about the gospel. There's really no reason to think that there's someone there that is not a candidate for the gospel if they have not already obeyed. And that's really just saying we need an awareness that there are people all around us. Sometimes we think of the perfect prospect. Maybe there is such. But more likely than not, there is someone there who may or may not have an interest. And all we can do is try and find out. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that this is simple to do, either in terms of making it habitual on our part, or in terms of the response that we might receive. I can only imagine, as I think through my mind, of asking different people about, say, coming to attend this meeting. There are going to be those who say, well, you know, I'm just too busy. I'd like to, but I don't have time for that. Or someone might reply by saying, well, you know, that's a long way away. I just, that seems like a long way to drive. And there might be other rationale that people would use. Maybe someone just say, well, you know, I'm not a religious person. I don't really see any sense in that. Well, does that mean that we need to just turn away from those people or make no further effort? Probably, if anything, it says that's all the more reason for us to be involved talking to them. You know, a lot of people are busy, but they usually make the time for what's important. And it's astounded me that I'll find people who are willing to drive great distances, even for a religious service, if there is enough motivation. And sure, there are people who have never been religious who would look at it and view it from the standpoint of being very odd. But that shouldn't deter us necessarily. That just says they've never really tried it on for size and seen what it's about. Could you imagine being Ananias when the Lord said, Ananias, you go to Saul and you go and teach him? And he replied just like we would. Lord, don't you know who this is that you're sending me to? He's the one that's been persecuting Christians. The Lord didn't take that as a resignation, say, okay, I get what you're saying. He said, you go and talk to him. And how many are there out there to whom we can at least make the attempt? and should be making the attempt. Well, what does it take to be someone who's involved in that? I realize that we all have different talents, different abilities. No two of us are alike. Some are much more efficient in terms of these things. It's like being a salesman. I don't know that everyone's cut out to be a salesman. But if you'll pardon the personal examples, I have observed myself, I meant to mention this to them beforehand, didn't get to, James Newman, on the one hand, who has certainly made efforts to do that. I don't think to be seen doing that, but he's enthusiastic, he's outgoing, he greets people, he talks to people, and that's a certain kind of personality that's very useful in interesting other people about the gospel. But that's not the only kind of person who can reach someone. There are others like a Pat O'Neill, maybe enthusiastic, but maybe a little more soft-spoken. And yet, going about his business, trying to find those who are interested and talk to them about the gospel. And you know, it's often interesting that the people who are most likely to do that, not always, but most likely, are the people who themselves were without the gospel, who were not raised in an environment where the gospel was being preached, and yet someone took the time to share it with them. Maybe suggesting that they appreciate to a greater extent what good can come of an effort to speak with somebody else, maybe a neighbor, maybe a friend at work, about the gospel and try and influence them. I'm simply suggesting that we all can have a part in this. It's not up to anyone to keep tabs. I'm sure efforts are being made. I know there are some groups that exert pressure on members and say, we're each responsible, therefore you do this, you do that. That's not the way that I see it in the New Testament. But that doesn't dismiss from us the responsibility that we have to try and reach others. And so I would like to simply encourage us this evening with these thoughts to do what we can in terms of this upcoming meeting. I've said it before, and I'll repeat it again. If you just think in terms of how many people we are able to reach with this congregation. You know, Atlanta is a big city, but you just start putting together how many people each of us knows. Say it's just 10 people that we know. If we would just make the attempt to share with them the gospel or just to invite them to the meeting, you multiply the number here this evening that could do so times 10, and you've got a lot of people being reached with the gospel. That's something that we should be about as a congregation. And so I will suggest in closing that as we prepare for this meeting, there is much to do for this meeting, if nothing else. There are efforts that we can make. And in fact, we've got forms at the back. If you'd like a personal invitation sent to someone, if you can think of some names, in the next 5 weeks, why, put those down and return those to me, and we'll have letters being sent out to these people. We're going to have a brief meeting after the services and just get any feedback or input from any of you that have ideas about what we can do more effectively to be reaching others. But most importantly, we want to try and reach out and reach others with the gospel of Christ. As we conclude this evening, we don't want to conclude the lesson without saying that there may be those in this audience who are amenable to the gospel. Maybe you're religious, maybe you have never been religious. But if you've heard the gospel and you are convinced that Jesus is who he says he is, that your sin has separated you from him, that the only way you can be right with God is to obey that gospel this evening, we would like to encourage you in order to do that. We invite you to come as together we stand and sing this song.